I will call this remote hearing of the Local Government Division to order. Today is March 10th, 2021. This meeting is being held in accordance with Rule 10.01, which was passed and allows remote hearings. All remote hearings are recorded and live streamed by House Public Information. Josh, if you would take the roll, please.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Representative Mason.
Present.
Representative Elkins.
Sorry, present.
Representative Quam.
Present.
Representative Berg.
Present.
Representative Bolden.
Present.
Representative Hewitt.
Present.
Representative Mecklen.
Present.
Representative Olson.
Present.
Representative Joaquin. Representative Joaquin. All present for Representative Joaquin at this time.
Okay. We do have a quorum, so we will begin. And next, we need to do the minutes for March 3rd. Representative Quam, have you read the minutes? What?
Madam Chair, I've read the minutes and prepared to move their approval.
Okay, sounds good. Yeah, all those in favor of the minutes as read, please say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign.
Aye.
Okay. So we have one dissenter. So we're going to consider the minutes that are approved as printed. Thank you so much. First bill on the list today is Representative Elkins, House File 1565. And the bill, let's see, what are we going to do? It was referred by state government finance, so it's going to have to go back to state government finance.
Yes, Madam Chair, I will move that House File 1565 be recommended to be re-referred to the State Government Finance and Elections Committee.
Okay, thank you, Representative Elkins. And if you would like to do your presentation for the bill,
please. Thank you. Yeah. I'm going to share my screen here again.
And I do want to interrupt 1 minute.
Yeah.
We have an aggressive schedule this morning, so this bill has to, I'm planning on having this finished by 9:20, including the amendments as well.
Yeah.
So just so that everybody's aware, if they would be as concise as possible, please.
All right. We're going to whip right through this, Madam Chair.
Okay.
Okay. So just a little bit of background, you know, local funding provides, you know, a very large share of the total funding for roads and bridges at all levels of government in the state. In fact, property taxes that you pay that support your city streets and county roads are the single largest source for funding for city streets and county roads at all levels in the state. Cities over 5,000 population get 9% of the gas tax revenues for the municipal state aid roads, which can comprise no more than 20% of a city's total street miles. Cities under 5,000 receive nothing from the gas tax. And overall, 45% of the funding for all roads and bridges in Minnesota is provided by local taxes paid by city and county taxpayers. And that share grows every year because we have not raised the gas tax or other sources of funds going into the highway user distribution fund for ages. I want to distinguish this between the street impact fee bill that we heard a few weeks ago, Representative Mason's bill. That one is suitable primarily for greenfield development areas that are coming under development for the first time. The Street Improvement District bill, which we're hearing this morning, is suitable primarily for redevelopment and intensifying development density. So this is more of a redevelopment tool, while Representative Mason's bill is more of a development tool for new areas. So I just want to illustrate, you know, how this would work for a simple hypothetical example. So let's take an intersection, busy suburban intersection, which is undergoing redevelopment from small strip malls into a big box power center. And the redevelopment of the intersection begins with Walmart building a superstore on the northeast corner. Then Costco comes on and builds one on the southwest corner. And with each of these, the congestion is getting worse. By the time Home Depot builds its store on the northeast corner, the congestion is getting intolerable. And finally, when Cub Foods comes in and wants to build a grocery store on the southeast corner, if the city approves that development, it's going to be the straw that breaks the camel's back. The intersection will fail and will have to be improved. So the question is, you know, what's the fairest way to pay for these improvements? So if it were not for this redevelopment activity, the intersection improvements would not be necessary. So why should local homeowners be saddled with paying for this improvement when in truth they don't want this extra development, this extra traffic in their neighborhood? And probably worthy of note that retail does not generally pay its own way from property taxes alone because of all of the traffic and police calls that it generates. It was in the Tischler Buys Fiscal Disparities Study from about 10 years ago, if anybody wants the reference. So the alternative would be, should Cub Foods be required to pick up the whole tab just because they were the last one in and the developer whose development broke the camel's back? I would argue that neither of those two approaches would be fair. So the way the street improvement district would work is that the city would establish a street improvement district that encompassed the intersection and these four properties that are generating all of the new traffic. And let's just say, to keep the math simple, that the intersection improvement would cost $1.5 million. Walmart is generating 5,000 trips a day, Costco 4,000, Home Depot 3,000, Cub 3,000. So each of them, you can calculate the share of the total trips that are being added to the intersection from these developments, and apportion the $1.5 million to each of these parcels based on the number of trips that they're generating. So Walmart would have a third of the trips, they would pay a third of the bill. Costco has 27% of the trips, they would pay $400,000. And Home Depot and Cub each generate 3,000 trips, 20% of the trips for each of them, and they would each pay $300,000. So that's it conceptually. When Mayor Norton testifies in a minute, we'll see an actual example of how this would work in process. And you're probably wondering then, how do we estimate the trips? So this is a change in the apportionment method from recent versions of this bill, and this bill is heard annually. We passed it last year out of this committee. But there is now a source that is being used by public transportation planners all over the country. MnDOT has a subscription, the council has a subscription, many cities have a subscription, including my home city of Bloomington. Data is compiled from cell phone movement data. The estimate is this contains about a one-third sample of all of the trips, so it's highly representative. The data is highly secured. Only aggregated data is shown. No individual trips are ever displayed, and the service is easily available and very easy to use. So in this bill version this year, we would be using a resource like this or something competitive with this to establish the actual number of chips generated by parcel. And with that, Madam Chair, I think we can move on to our test wires. And I'm going to stop sharing here.
Okay. Thank you. The first person that I have is Michael Thompson. If you would identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Yes, thank you, Chair Mason and Vice Chair Elkins. You did a great job covering that. I will be very brief here. My name is Michael Thompson. I'm the Public Works Director for the City of Plymouth, and today I'm representing the City Engineers Association of Minnesota as its current president. We're a statewide association of municipal engineers that design, operate, and maintain city roads and bridges. This enabling legislation, we believe, is equitable, is based on actual data, and usage. It also holds cities accountable to a public process and is fair in the distribution of costs. It also ensures those users that pay into the system actually receive the benefit of that investment. It does not prohibit cities from collecting fees from tax-exempt properties, some of which can be significant traffic generators. If the users of streets don't pay for repairs, then the taxpayers end up carrying the burden for others. Existing funding mechanisms for local street maintenance and improvements are limited, as you know. Municipal state aid funding is limited to cities with a population over 5,000, like Representative Elkins mentioned. So only 148 out of 853 cities in the entire state are available for those funds. And of the small number of cities, they can only designate that revenue on 20% of their roadway mileage. So just for an example, in Plymouth, we have 325 miles. Only 65 miles are available for that investment. State aid cities receive only about $11 for every $1,000 of needs, which is about 1/6 the amount compared to 1990. So as we grow, more cities must now share the money and revenues. Back when this was established in 1958, there were only 58 cities receiving that or splitting that money. Now there's 148. So cities are relegated to looking at hefty property taxes, issuing more debt, increasing special assessments, which are never popular, or worst of all, delaying much needed investments. And according to the DOT, every dollar spent on street maintenance saves roughly $7 in repairs. So if the city decides to use this tool, some may not, property owners would pay for improvements and maintenance with manageable fees over time, just like how you and I pay a monthly water or sewer bill. In conclusion, this enabling legislation could be used to mitigate those big property tax increases, ensure all users pay for the system they use, help reduce or eliminate those large special assessments, and ensure communities, both large and small, metro and outstate, have a reliable tool to fix our streets. The City Engineers Association strongly supports this bill. Thank you for your time and consideration, and I'll be available to answer any questions you may have. Thank you.
Thank you. And we'll take the questions after all the testifiers. Next, we have the Mayor of Rochester, Kim Norton, and it's nice to have you back in the house, even if virtually.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's great to be here. Thank you for hearing this bill, and thank you, Representative Elkins, for carrying this. I want to just be clear. I'm testifying today on behalf of the League of Minnesota Cities, a statewide association representing 835 of Minnesota's 853 cities. Both the League of Minnesota Cities and the City of Rochester are in support of this bill. This is a bill that gives elected officials the authority to use a new tool for street funding. It is in support of local control. The bill requires a robust and transparent process, including public hearings and notice to property owners. The process will ensure that local elected officials will hear the concerns of impacted property owners before making the decision about whether to create a street improvement district. This would be a very useful tool for my community. Similar to other cities in Minnesota, Rochester will face major financial constraints in the future due to the cost of maintaining and repairing the city's network of streets. Currently, we have over 100 miles of streets that are over 50 years old, many much older. This presents a looming financial challenge for the City of Rochester and many cities across the state of Minnesota. There is currently $9 million of annual funding for preserving and rehabilitating construction and reconstruction. However, Rochester is facing an annual shortfall of $23 million to adequately address current and future needs of the city for the next 50 years. Utilizing traditional methods such as tax levy would place a heavy burden on Rochester residents and their business and our businesses. The city needs to diversify its revenue sources with an alternative method to help defray the cost of street improvements. The bill would allow revenues to be collected for and placed in a separate account to be used exclusively for street maintenance projects, reconstruction, or to provide preventative maintenance to extend the road's life cycle. It would allow the city to transition away from assessments that can inequitably impact a property owner based on the timing of property ownership, and we hear this concern a lot. In addition, the greatest street construction needs in residential areas are often going to be in the areas that will have the greatest challenge in paying the assessment. For businesses, including tax-exempt properties, assessments represent a significant financial commitment while they are simultaneously navigating impacts from construction. In summary, enacting a street improvement district will allow the city to have a long-term financial plan which addresses the growing infrastructure needs, lowers the financial investment needed over time, and begins to address a significant unfunded future liability. Again, thank you very much for hearing this bill. It is very important for our community and communities across the state.
Thank you. Next, we have Amber Backus.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Amber Backus. I'm with the Minnesota Automobile Dealers Association, but I'm also speaking on behalf of 30 other organizations who are opposed to House File 1565 and the authorization of street improvement fees. And there is a handout in your packet that lists all of the opponents to the bill. For approximately two decades, this concept has brought together a diverse group of stakeholders united in our opposition to the bill. Our coalition includes folks from the private sector to the nonprofit sector, hospitals to higher education, trucking companies to boat manufacturers, churches and synagogues, and lots of Main Street businesses who are opposed, not just big box retailers. And while Representative Elkins portrayed this as a redevelopment bill, there is nothing that limits the use of this fee to redevelopment. As you heard from Mayor Norton and see in the handouts from the League of Minnesota Cities and the City of Rochester, this is largely about paying for ongoing street maintenance, which cities are not prioritizing in their general fund budgets. There have been many versions of this bill over the years, and House File 1565 brings it full circle with the return of trip generation, which was in the first bills in the early 2000s as the basis for calculating the fee. Excuse me. A little disjointed here with my mouse. One second. While new technology may improve the accuracy of how the number of trips a property generates is determined, this does not correct the underlying problems that have long plagued this bill. We respectfully disagree with the proponents of the bill that this establishes a funding tool with a direct relationship between those who pay for fees for an infrastructure improvement and the location of those improvements. This bill grants cities broad authority to draw the districts however they want. There is no requirement that the property owners benefit from the improvements or even be in the vicinity of them. Districts could be gerrymandered to include commercial and industrial properties in order to spare residential properties from paying the fees. Or they could be drawn to capture revenues from hospitals and religious institutions that are exempt from property taxes. It would be much more politically palatable for cities to do this instead of raising property taxes. In fact, the handout in your packets from the City of Rochester says as much, quote, utilizing traditional methods such as the tax levy would place a heavy burden on the citizens of Rochester, unquote. And while we appreciate that Representative Elkins reduced some of the variability from last biennium's bill by narrowing the list of options for determining how the fees can be calculated, trip generation, as portrayed by the proponents, does not create a direct link between users and the investments being made. First, not all roads that pass through a municipality are maintained by it. State and county highways are also located within a city's borders. Why should trips generated along these non-municipal roadways determine how much a property owner pays for improvements on city streets located elsewhere in one of these districts? And furthermore, while this new tax is based on vehicle traffic, it can be used to pay for many other infrastructure improvements beyond city streets. As you can see in Section 1, the proceeds can also be used to pay for sewers, utility connections, fences, trails, pathways, all of which aren't necessarily tied to vehicle use. And lastly, while Representative Elkins shed some light on the source for determining these trips, that isn't explicitly identified in the bill. It only says that the source will be certified as suitable for this purpose by the Commissioner of Transportation. And there's some heartburn over what that means and how that determination of what's a suitable source will be made. And also, if it's a private company, as was shared in the testimony, how easy will it be for impacted property owners to access and interpret the data if they'd like to challenge the fee? These new fees put businesses that are assessed them at a significant competitive disadvantage. Imagine if you're the owner of a small Main Street business and you're assessed this fee while your competitor a few blocks away is not. We do understand that cities are struggling to keep up with the burgeoning costs of transportation projects, but they have at least seven other funding mechanisms at their disposal to pay for local roads. And we think those are fair and more transparent than what's being proposed in this bill. Additionally, those other mechanisms don't face the other major drawback of this proposal, that it's potentially unconstitutional. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Roberts to address the constitutional issues surrounding this legislation. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Mr. Roberts, if you'll identify yourself and proceed.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Ethan Roberts. I'm the Director of Government Affairs for the Jewish Community Relations Council of Minnesota and the Dakotas. We've been part of this coalition for quite some time, and I would add that for the purposes of saving time, I'm also speaking on behalf of the Catholic Conference of Minnesota. As Ms. Baucus indicated, there are some policy-related issues on both sides about the policy merits of the overall bill, and more specifically, we could debate the policy wisdom of assessing fees, as they're called, but in reality, they operate as taxes from tax-exempt properties. However, I think before we get to this policy point, we need to first ask ourselves, does the legislature have that authority? Can the legislature supersede Minnesota's state constitution? So explicitly, I'm referring to Article 10 and our case law to essentially levy taxes on tax-exempt properties outside of the ways which the courts have recognized, and indeed our constitution, such taxes can be levied. So let me be clear. In Representative Elkin's PowerPoint presentation, and I really wish I was good at PowerPoint because I would have come up with one of my own, we saw a great map, right, with the four businesses at an intersection. Now imagine that is not just the sum total of the street improvement fee district, as Ms. Baucus indicated. It could extend in many directions for several miles. If I could draw further that map, I could place a church, I could place a hospital, I could place a college, all several miles away from that intersection, and they could also be part of that district. And while they would have trips, as there's great, great care, obviously, about how to figure out how much each entity within the district pays, there's absolutely no requirement that there be any benefit, any direct benefit, to those taxes and this is not really something that we can just sort of it means, and we can all have our own idea. There's case law on this, and looking even at the most recent decision that's relevant, the 2016 Supreme Court decision, which I know the League of Cities is well aware, lays out what every property tax assessor knows that you have to improve the value of the property in order to pay for that. So our issue of the bill is, again, not a policy difference. It's frankly constitutional. It's legal. And this is not, in our estimation, a bug in it's a feature. As the city indicates, one of the four main benefits of the bill is the ability to capture revenue. You can call it fees, but again, I don't know honestly if proponents are claiming they're doing this under the policing power or their PIGO, that they wouldn't be trying to pursue the policing theory because they have that authority to do that. And we heard this from Mr. Thompson. I live in Plymouth, but streets are great. Thank you for your work that you're doing. We heard this from Mayor Norton. Again, this is something that's really driving this bill is this ability to capture revenue. Call it fees if you want, from properties that you don't have a legal right to take revenue from. And, mm-hmm. With that, I do recognize that there is an exemption for some taxes and properties in the bill. There are several subdivisions which come before that of property taxes and properties which could be swept up in this. But if I'm wrong, and the intent of the bill is to not, in fact, capture revenue from tax-exempt properties, then we could certainly fix that pretty easily. But my sense is then there wouldn't be much point in having the bill, because as stated in the League of City fact sheet, this is one of the main features. So I'll stop at that, and you know, happy to answer any questions when it's my turn, if there are questions from the committee. And again, thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Okay, thank you. The next person I have is Matt Spellman.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. For the record, my name is Matt Spellman, and I'm with the Minnesota Realtors Association. Minnesota Realtors is a statewide business trade association with over 21,000 members helping buyers and sellers transfer property all across Minnesota. Given that you heard me testify several times in this committee on bills with which we have similar concerns, I will be keeping my remarks brief and focus on how this bill may impact housing. You heard me mention last week that our housing market is extremely strained due to demand on a very limited supply. Consequently, we are seeing costs of existing houses drastically rise, adversely impacting low to moderate income earners most. House File 1565 establishes a mechanism by which local units of government are able to impose an additional cost burden on property owners to finance public infrastructure projects, when we believe cities should prioritize within their budgets and use the tools they already have to pay for such projects. Adding an additional layer of cost to homeowners at a time when housing prices continue to rise is the reason why we must respectfully oppose House File 1565. We would encourage the legislature to focus on things within its control that impact the cost of housing and help make sure that no additional costs are imposed on homeowners, particularly as our economy is recovering from COVID-19. Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Okay, thank you very much. Is there anyone else that wanted to testify? We have everybody that had let us know ahead of time. Okay, in that case, Representative Elkins, did you want to say anything before I open it up to questions? Because I know there was a lot of comments in there. Do you want to wait till after?
We can take questions now.
Okay. I'm not seeing any questions right now. Okay. Representative Quam. And
thank
then
you, okay.
Proceed, please.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted a clarification from the author. This software and your modeling, how granularity is it to hours and days for trips? In other words, houses of worship tend to have their traffic not during the week. Certain businesses tend to have their traffic peak at certain times of day. So when you're looking at capacity, generally you're looking at the commute time in the morning for some locations in the evening, and others you're looking at during the lunch hour. So if you could enlighten us on that detail, and thank you.
Representative Elkins.
Madam Chair, Representative Quam, yes, no, the bill specifies that it should be the aggregate number of trips over the course of the previous quarter. So one of the ironic things about this is that both auto dealerships and churches over the course of a week generate very little traffic compared to other uses. Churches or synagogues may generate traffic or mosques on either Friday, Saturday, or Sunday, but most of the rest of the week they're generating almost no traffic at all. So even if a church or a place of worship were, you know, captured within a street improvement district, their share of the assessment would end up being small because they just don't generate that much traffic in the aggregate.
Madam Chair.
Any response, Representative Quam?
I'm not sure if my area is different. There are a lot of daycare. There are a lot of schools that are located with churches. We have some of our churches are very active, say on Wednesdays for other groups. So I think the generalization, I understand where it's coming from, but if we're talking about designing and doing projections on specific areas, locations, intersections, and you've got this wonderful tool. It doesn't sound like it has the granularity to be able to actually understand, aggregate is a whole lot different than when you have peak traffic times. Anyone that's decided whether they're going to do the street route or get onto the freeway, the first thing they think about, what time of day is it? Because one is going to be horrible during a portion of the time and the other won't, or vice versa. And that, I would think, if you're planning street, improvements, that you'd probably be, taking that into consideration. So you've confirmed that it's a general tool, but it might not be as precise for really doing a wonderful job of planning. Thank you.
Yeah, Madam Chair.
Representative Elkins.
Just to clarify, the tool itself, has very granular data. In fact, the primary use of the tool is to do exactly what you just described, is to analyze traffic flows by location, by time of day. A typical use would be a city is looking at closing a street for reconstruction and trying to figure out, well, if we close this street, how would the traffic flow around that closure? So the underlying data is quite granular. But to preserve privacy, it's only presented at the level of granularity that's needed to solve a particular business problem that's faced by a transportation planner, and it never reveals individual trips.
Thank you. Any response, Representative Kwan?
I think I will, after the questioning, do a close-up, but I do have a few points that came out of that.
Okay. Representative Mecklen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do have a handful of questions as well. How have cities over the past, say, five decades managed to maintain these roads and intersections? And where is this sudden new need for funding coming from, particularly at, like as one testifier said, coming out of the COVID thing with, trying to rebuild our economy, yet we're going to add more cost to these businesses and perhaps the author of the bill could help me understand when you impose a fee on a business, who in the end ends up paying that fee?
Madam Chair,
Representative Elkins.
Yes. This isn't a sudden problem. This problem has been coming on for, forever. I mean, we have not raised the gas tax since 2008, which means that the cities which receive, cities over 5,000 get about 9% of the gas tax revenue. That's been flat since 2008. And so every year, the share of road and street construction and maintenance that has to be borne by property taxers at the county and city level grows. And it grows every year. And the problem continuously gets worse. But it's not a new problem. That's why this bill has been heard in one form or another since the 2000s. Mr. Strohmeyer found many minutes for me testifying in favor of an earlier version of this bill when I was a Bloomington City Council member.
Response, Representative Mecklen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I didn't hear the answer to the part of if you're going to assess these fees on whether it's Home Depot or Costco in your example. At the end of the day, it's the consumer that pays it, regardless of who you assess it to.
Yeah.
With everybody's budgets being strained, especially after the last year we've been through, is this really the thing we want to do to the Minnesota taxpayer right now? I mean, is this really the direction that we have to go? And why are these cities not managing their budgets better to maintain the roads with the funds they already take in?
Representative Elkins.
Madam Chair, Representative Mecklen. These costs get paid one way or the other, but when there's not enough money to adequately fund road maintenance, the roads deteriorate, and as the Plymouth City engineer testified to, if you get the maintenance done in time before the roads have gone, failed too far, it's a lot cheaper to do preventative maintenance than it is to do reconstruction. that, you know, it you're either going to pay it through a tool like this, or you are going to end up paying it through property taxes. And if the work isn't done in a timely manner, the amount of property taxes required to do it is going to be larger.
Okay. Representative Hewitt, did you, I saw your hand up. Did you put it down, or am I not?
Madam Chair, I'll take my questions offline for Mr. Roberts and Mr. Spielman in the interest
okay.
of time here.
All right, then I will take Representative Olson next, and then I'd like to move to the amendments.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I guess I have kind of a question here, but I'm getting really kind of tired of the fact that I didn't really join this committee to try and fight these hidden fees that are consistently being brought up in this committee. You know, we see commercials all the time about television companies and phone companies and credit card companies where they broadly proclaim that they don't have any hidden fees. And this here is another hidden fee we're talking about. But here's a question. I think it's for the mayor of Rochester, because I need an explanation from someone who has dealt in a similar situation as a mayor of a town, or maybe someone who's a council member. Tell me, you've got, let's say, Walmart. I've got one Walmart in my district. It's in Fairmont. They pay $500,000 a year in taxes, $500,000 a year in taxes to the city in their property taxes. So most of that's going to the city. And I'm wondering how, if you have a $1.5 million street improvement that you're doing, let's say your city can't even afford it to begin with, all right? You can't afford to put in the intersection. You can't do it. You're strapped. You can go and you can get a 30-year bond issued for that street improvement right there. That's a $1.5 million intersection. That will not cost you $500,000 a year. This is an investment in your town having a business that pays an exceptional amount of money in property taxes. That is a lot of money. I don't understand why we want to put another fee on them, or why we want to even strap. You know, I understand you look at it, you say, oh, Walmart. I can tell you, from a person who has to drive 35 miles to get to a Walmart, I wish that I had another Walmart in my community, all right? I would do whatever I could to keep a Walmart in my community, because we have no other options. But that being said, let's talk about small businesses. Let's talk about homeowners. Why are we trying to put more hidden fees when credit card companies and phone companies are telling you that we have no hidden fees? We're giving cities those tools. So please, someone answer that question for me, because it's very confusing to me.
Mayor Norton, do you want to take that?
Sure, I can just start, and then if Representative Elkins or someone else wants to address it, they can. First of all, this wouldn't be a hidden fee. This is a very public process that we would take to the community and public notice them and have robust discussions in our community about doing this. Secondly, when we have to do road repairs, there's an assessment currently. This is just assessing in a different way than is currently being done. And again, Rochester was built in 1854. The roads were built, many of them, particularly in the older parts of town, were all built at a similar time. And we as a city are strapped with an aging infrastructure. They can't be repaired anymore. We're dealing with this on North Broadway, the main road through town. It has been fixed up, and immediately after a repair is done, it crumbles. It isn't safe for our community to drive on it, and we're trying to find a fairer, more transparent way to offer the assessment so that it's spread out more equitably over a larger group of people and held in an account for future repairs in that same district. So I think it's as equitable as it can be, it's as transparent as it can be, and it's one more tool for a city to use with their businesses to get the job done. With this aging infrastructure, we can't possibly manage. It's all coming due at the same time, if you will.
Madam Chair?
Elkins?
Yeah, just to add on to that, it was an excellent answer. But, the bottom line here is that for these kinds of expenses, this is just a fairer way to assess them than rather than, for example, linear street frontage. The court case that Mr. Roberts cited involved a fee that was being applied citywide by the city of St. Paul based on linear street footage. And churches in particular were being hit disproportionately because the amount of traffic that they generate isn't proportional to their street footage. So this is just a fairer way to, collect these costs, from a more limited, group of users who are directly, impacting the operations of a street. As other testifiers said, there's lots of different ways it could be done. This is just fairer than all of those other ways. Thank you.
Representative Olson, I'll let you have a response and then we'll move to
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have one final follow-up question then. The City of Rochester, do you believe that Mayo Health Systems doesn't pay enough in their property taxes to begin with to pay for the maintenance of the roads on their intersections that we're trying to parcel out into their own district? Because I assume that they're paying a considerable amount of money, and they've been around since the 1800s.
Mayo Clinic pays, thank you, Madam Chair, I'm sorry. Mayo Clinic does pay some taxes, but they're also a not-for-profit, so it's a mixed bag depending on which building and which portion of Mayo Clinic we're talking about. All businesses and all citizens pay property taxes. A street assessment, and as I mentioned, we are not collecting enough taxes to do the 50-year and older street road repairs. So this is an additional tool, which we've been using already in a different way, to make sure that the assessment is paid over a larger group of people, which probably will include Mayo Clinic, yes, but they also generate a lot of the roads and trips in that area. So do I think they have paid their fair share of property taxes? I don't think that's really relevant to this particular question, but do I think they should help us repair the roads in the areas surrounding their buildings? I think that's a fair thing to ask them, and I'll leave it at that.
Thank you. Representative Quam, do you have the A1 amendment? Do you want to move that?
Madam Chair, I have the A6 amendment, but the A1, I think, is Representative Olson. The A2 is Representative Olson. The A3 is Representative Mecklen. A4 is Mecklen. A5 is Olson, and I would have A6.
Okay, let me... The first two I know are Olson. Representative Olson, do you want to move the A1 amendment?
Yes, Madam Chair, please. The A1 amendment would exempt properties that are owned by hospitals that do charity work. So as the mayor of Rochester was talking about how Mayo Health Systems does, in fact, have some non-tax properties that they utilize as a result of their charity work. And so that's why I would move for this amendment to be adopted. And I would request a roll call on this vote.
Okay. Representative Elkins, do you have a...
Yes, Madam Chair, and I have a question for the author or Representative Quam. In this amendment, it says on page 3, line 30, after charity, insert, and other exceptions. What does other and other exceptions refer to?
Representative Olson.
So the exceptions would be, we have a laundry list of exceptions that we're going to be bringing forward in the form of amendments, I believe.
In these various amendments, but this the line in reference refers specifically to the subdivision in the bill that refers to charity organizations. So that's the only exception that's in there, and I just found that wording, which is found in all six of these, to be confusing in terms of what those exceptions are that are being referenced, because it's in the section that just refers to nonprofit charity organizations, and that one is spelled out pretty clearly.
Representative Olson, and then I want to take the vote.
Yeah, I think what you say, that you do have a point there, Representative Hawkins. I appreciate that. It does muddy things a little bit, and it's a fair argument to say that it might be a little confusing. Representative Quam has his hand up. He may have some extra clarification to the fog that's in the air.
Okay, Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And part of the issue is that there are several dozen organizations of which have problems with this bill. And each community tends to have a different mix of what's going on, and things don't always fit into the square peg, round hole type situation. There may be organizations that are doing charity type work. There might be several groups together that have a space that's utilized for periodic free clinic. The county would come in, use that space for inoculations, for exams, for children. We've got a community in my district where we have summer ag workers that come in that, and we try to provide health care and other functions for those. And it's meant to have a little bit of flexibility, with those. Plus, we don't know which of the amendments may be accepted, and we wanted to allow for, that flexibility. I'm sure at the next committee, when we add these amendments, we'll work together and have very good clarifying language on that. Thank you.
Okay.
Representative Elkins, yeah. Do you want to accept the amendment?
No, I don't, Madam Chair. So the key issue here is that every hospital provides charity care. It's required by federal law. So the effect of this amendment would be to exempt every hospital in the state, including, since we're using it as an example, the Mayo Clinic, which had $728 million in net operating income last year. And personally, I think that, Mayor Norton's being very diplomatic, but I think that an organization like Mayo with $728 million in net operating income ought to be paying its fair share of the street improvements for the traffic that it generates in downtown Rochester. So, no, I do not recommend accepting this amendment.
Okay. Josh, would you take the roll, please?
Representative Mason.
No.
Representative Elkins.
No.
Representative Quam.
Yes.
Representative Berg.
No.
Representative Bolden.
No.
Representative Hewitt.
No.
Representative Mecklen.
Yes.
Representative Olson.
Yes.
Representative Joaquin.
No.
We have 6 no's and 3 ayes.
Okay, the motion does not prevail. We'll move on to the A2 amendment, and that also is Representative Olson's.
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you. I'll move the A2 amendment. What this does is this would exempt congressionally authorized veteran organizations, so institutions such as the Veterans of Foreign Wars and the American Legion buildings.
Okay.
And I would request a roll call on this as well. It has to do with our veterans. I'm a service member myself. It's important to me that we recognize their sacrifices, which are much, much more than what I've done.
Thank you. Representative Elkins?
Yeah, Madam Chair. I rather strongly suspect that these kinds of organizations already fall within the definition of the charitable organizations that are in the bill already. And we also like the First Amendment includes that muddying and other exceptions language as well. So I would recommend a no vote. In fact, what I would suggest to Representative Quam and Representative Olson is that this bill will be going to state government finance next. If these amendments, could be withdrawn in the interest of saving time, I would be happy to work with the two of them and the League of Cities to craft some language that really gets at more what we're trying to get at with this series of amendments.
Representative Olson.
Yeah, I appreciate the sentiment on that, and so I would be interested in withdrawing the A5 amendment that I will be talking about, and we can discuss this in a further situation. Let's move on with the A2, though.
You do want to vote?
Since we're halfway there already.
Okay. And you asked for a roll call. Did I get that?
Yep, that's correct,
okay.
Madam Chair.
Okay, Josh, if you would take the roll, please.
Representative Mason.
No.
Representative Elkins.
No.
Representative Quam.
Yes.
Representative Berg.
No.
Representative Bolden.
No.
Representative Hewitt.
Pass.
Representative Mecklen.
Yes.
Representative Olson.
Yes.
Representative Joachim.
No.
We have 5 no's and 3 yeses.
Okay. The motion does not prevail. Next is the A3 amendment, and I believe Representative Mecklen, that's yours.
Yes, Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to move the A3 amendment. What this amendment would do was it would exempt principal residences of senior citizens and retirees who are living on a fixed income. And as to Representative Elkins' question earlier with the language where it says, and other exceptions, perhaps we could turn to our researcher, Chelsea, for clarification. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Ms. Griffin?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, yes, the language of and other exceptions was intended to encompass any of the language of the amendments should they be adopted. If the language needs to be clarified, I'd be happy to work with the members of the committee and Representative Elkins on better language. Thanks.
Okay. I'm not seeing any hands, so I'd like to take a vote on this one.
Madam Chair, I'd like to ask for a roll call.
Okay. Josh, would you take the roll, please? Oh, Representative Elkins.
Yeah, Madam Chair, the main comment I would have about this proposed amendment is I don't know how you would determine the residences of retirees. I don't think that there is data at the municipal level that would allow this exception to be implemented. So I do recommend a no vote.
Okay. Josh, the roll, please.
Representative Mason.
No.
Representative Elkins.
No.
Representative Quam.
Yes.
Representative Berg.
No.
Representative Bolden.
No.
Representative Hewitt.
No.
Representative Mecklen.
Yes.
Representative Olson.
Yes.
Representative Joachim.
No.
We have 6 no's and 3 yeses.
Okay. So the amendment is not adopted. And at this point, it is already 9:23. So I'm going to request that the following amendments be presented at the next at the next level, so we can take a vote on this bill, because I do want to make sure we hear the other 3 bills. Yes, sir.
The reason I voted no on the minutes is we didn't have in the minutes noted that we had skipped amendments on a previous bill. In fact, we skipped all of the amendments on the previous bill. Now, on this bill, we are skipping amendments. And, you know, plus I thought that there was going to be time given to, you know, sum up, I guess, the minority side and have a voice there.
I apologize. You're right. Okay. I'm sorry. If Representative Quam, again, we need to get through the other bills, and we've spent almost an hour on this. So if you would like to make your closing argument, and then Representative Elkins, and we'll take the vote.
Well, Madam Chair, I guess I'm disappointed that a lot of the discussion that I wanted was on the churches and the nonprofits to show that there are entities that have not been hit with, you know, with this type of fee tax, however you want to put it, and that the software you know, has some generalities in it, and actually you're designing for the peak, and if you have the mix in that area that spreads the different peaks at a lower level, that would have a impact. You know, and frankly, I don't think that this is fair enough for the communities in general and some of the different communities. You know, we've heard several bills from Rochester, and Rochester has done a pretty decent job. It has doubled in the last few decades. 50 years ago, it was a much smaller community, and you know, it's doubled. So that the discussion of Rochester doesn't match statewide, and you know, frankly, I would have liked if we had had multiple other cities talking, because this bill is made for across the state, different size cities, different communities that vary a great deal. And frankly, I don't think it's, you know, quite there yet. And it is a little bit disappointing that we weren't, or we seem to be pushing it off for the next committee for amendments for here. And in the next committee, they had to be, the chair had to be reminded repeatedly that there were amendments that needed to be heard. And so I don't have high confidence that the next committee won't. Well, we ran out of time and we don't have it. So I'm disappointed. I do know the constraints, because we've both been through this deadline week, and I'm just hoping that things go a little bit better in the future. Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you. And again, I apologize, but we've spent an hour on the bill and there's still three more. Representative Elkins, did you have any closing remarks?
Madam Chair.
Okay. Is that Representative Meckland?
That is correct, Madam Chair.
Okay, quickly, please.
So you're suggesting that we push these amendments off to the next stop, which I'm not even on that committee, so I wouldn't have the opportunity to even bring forward an amendment there, for one. For two, this is our job to vet these bills, and to push this through like this hard without even being able to get through all the questions. I understand we're on a time crunch. We're always on a time crunch. But perhaps this would be the time that I'm going to move to table this bill, because it's clearly not ready for time. Prime time. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. So would I need to just, can we do that?
Madam Chair, a motion to table the bill is non-debatable.
Okay. And can we do that orally, or do we need to do a roll call?
If a roll call is requested, we can do a roll call, but if it's not, I think we can do it orally.
Madam Chair, I request a roll call.
Madam Chair, you're muted.
Sorry about that. Okay, we are going to do the roll call on the motion to table this bill. Josh, if you would take the roll, please.
Representative Mason.
No.
Representative Elkins.
No.
Representative Quam.
Yes.
Representative Byrd.
No.
Representative Bolden.
No.
Representative Hewitt.
No.
Representative Mecklen.
Yes.
Representative Olson.
Yes.
Representative Joachim.
No.
We have 6 no's and 3 yeses.
Okay, so the motion does not prevail. And Representative Elkins, did you want to do a final comment on the bill before we take the roll?
No, I think we've had a good discussion, Madam Chair. So.
Josh, would you take the roll on House File, I think it's 1565?
1565, yes.
Okay, and it will be going to state government finance.
And I so move, Madam Chair.
All righty. Representative Mason.
Yes.
Representative Elkins.
Aye.
Representative Kwan.
No.
Representative Byrd.
Yes.
Representative Bolden.
Aye.
Representative Hewitt.
Yes.
Representative Mecklen.
No.
Representative Olson.
No.
Representative Joachim.
Yes.
We have 6 yeses and 3 noes.
Okay, so the motion prevails. You are going, the bill is going to state government. Thank you. Thank Next, you, Representative Olson, I know I'm kind of putting you under the gun here, but we'll move. I will move House File 1481, and it will be returning to State Government Finance and Elections Committee. If you'd proceed, please, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Good to be here with you. So House File 1481 is a bill to allow the Duluth Seaway Port Authority to create a nonprofit entity to assist them in carrying out key elements of their mission while effectively managing risk. So the bill is before the committee to satisfy the requirements of Minnesota Statute 465.717, which allows for government entities to create a corporation, but only with the authorization of the legislature. As you will hear from my testifier, the Seaway Port is an incredible asset for our state. The Port Authority owns and manages tens of millions of dollars worth of transportation infrastructure on behalf of the state at the Clure Public Marine Terminal. Meanwhile, the port has also has a separate but related mission to engage in economic development and brownfields redevelopment, with a goal of bringing business and development to the region and the state. That is the part of the port's mission that this bill seeks to enhance. My testifier today is Jeff Stallenwerk, the Director of Government and Environmental Affairs for the Duluth Seaway Port Authority, who provide the more information on the port's work and why this proposal is needed. With that, Madam Chair, I will turn it over to Jeff.
And Mr. Stallenwerk, if you would identify yourself and proceed, please.
Thank you, Chair Mason, members, and Representative Olson. My name is Jeff Stallenwerk. I'm the Director of Government and Environmental Affairs at the Duluth Seaway Port Authority. The Port of Duluth Superior is the largest port on the Great Lakes and ranks among the top 20 ports in the United States. We typically handle an average of 35 million tons of maritime cargo and host approximately 800 vessel visits each year. As the Duluth Seaway Port Authority works to bring business to the port and economic development to the region, we leverage the unique and valuable transportation assets in the Port of Duluth Superior that are an economic engine for our region and the state. In addition to operating the multimodal logistics hub at the Clure Public Marine Terminal, the Port Authority also has a separate but related mission to engage in brownfields redevelopment. In this area of work, we acquire distressed commercial and industrial properties, including structures and equipment, which may include unanticipated or unknown liabilities due to either physical conditions or the presence of legacy pollutants. The Port Authority brings expertise and financial resources to clean up, restore, and repurpose these brownfield properties for redevelopment. As our brownfield activities grow, we would like to separate the risks associated with this work from the business assets at the Clure Public Marine Terminal. We are also looking ahead to our redevelopment of the U.S. Steel site in the Gary neighborhood of Duluth. It's a big project, redevelopment project, and it will be difficult to get enough public funds to complete. So it's a property where it may make sense to invite private investment to facilitate development. The proposed legislation allows us to create an entity that can collaborate with a private company and complete redevelopment of this property. There is precedent for government entities to create a nonprofit corporation for economic development activities. The most similar example to Duluth is the St. Paul Port Authority, where business activities extend beyond economic development and include port terminal and operations. The St. Paul Port Authority created Capital City Properties, a nonprofit arm of the Port Authority, to support land acquisition, commercial redevelopment, and property management. CCP was created by the Port Authority prior to 1997 legislation that required the legislature's express authorization for a local government unit to create a nonprofit corporation. So in summary, the bill before you satisfies the requirements of Minnesota Statutes 465 and allows the Duluth Seaway Port Authority to create a nonprofit corporation that reduces business risks in our economic development efforts and enables us to partner with private companies on our redevelopment projects. Thank you again, Chair Mason, and I will stand by for questions.
Thank you. And I also have a Shane Zark. If you'd identify yourself, please, and proceed.
Sure. Chair Mason and members, my name is Shane Zart with the firm Flaherty & Hood, and I'm a legislative consultant for the Duluth Seaway Port Authority. And for the sake of time, you'll be happy to hear Representative Olson and Jeff did a great job. So I'm just here in the event that I can help them respond to member questions and be helpful to you, if at all possible. So thank you, and I'll stand for questions, too.
I appreciate that. Thank you very much. Okay, I am not seeing any questions at this point. Okay, one. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I understand the reason of separating out liability, but I also understand there were some properties in St. Paul where there were cleanup and other liabilities. And my concern is if you're shifting this off to a nonprofit to isolate the Port Authority, that nonprofit, ceases to exist, evaporates because there's a multi-million dollar cleanup thing that comes up. In the end of the day, those funds are probably going to be supplied by the state, and be a liability for the entire state, and just instead of just a liability to the city of Duluth. So explain to me how shifting it to a nonprofit doesn't cause the liability to, end up with the state taxpayer. Thank you.
Representative Olson, who would you like to answer that?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will turn that over to Mr. Stollenwerk.
Mr. Stollenwerk, please.
Madam Chair, members, the Port Authority owns and manages the Clear Public Marine Terminal, which has received significant investment from the state of Minnesota, and we operate that public terminal on behalf of the state of Minnesota. And so the interest here is to separate that asset or those assets at the terminal, which the state has a very large interest in already, separated from our brownfields redevelopment work. I don't know if that answers your question.
Representative Quam.
I'm not surprised by it. It doesn't really answer, but it does indicate it's a pass the buck to the state because it's a state issue anyway. It doesn't make me feel any easier. It doesn't surprise me. And I don't want to name the site or sites in St. Paul that we've seen some issues with. I just was hoping there was a better way of approaching this. And we can always argue it's better for the state anyway or more appropriate than having it impact the city or the Port Authority. I just wanted to make sure that this was brought up, that if you're bringing it up to isolate, that's sort of passing the buck. And I guess we've covered that then. Thanks.
Okay. Representative Olson, would you like to make closing remarks? I'm not seeing any other comments.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think my testifiers did a great job in explaining and just ask for member support of the bill.
Okay. Josh, would you take the roll, please?
Representative Mason.
Aye.
Representative Elkins.
I am sorry, I was muted.
Representative Quam.
Aye.
Representative Berg.
Aye.
Representative Bolden.
Aye.
Representative Hewitt.
Aye.
Representative Mecklen.
Aye.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Joachim.
Aye.
And I'm sorry, Representative Quam, could you say that one more time?
Aye.
Thank you. We have 9 ayes, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you. So the motion prevails. House File 1481 will be going to State Government Finance and Elections Committee. Thank you. Representative Olson, do you want to move? Well, I will move House File 1947. And if you would talk to your bill, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I have an A1 amendment. Could we, would you be willing to move that and to get the bill in the shape for discussion?
Yes. I will move House File A1. And if you would like to elaborate on that.
Sure, Madam Chair. So the A1 makes a change that will be described in greater detail by the testifier, but this is something that when the DEC was formed in 1963, they really haven't had many statutory updates. So this was something that the board proposed to move the bid requirement up to 50,000, which is consistent with other like entities. And so that amendment reflects that change and would like to vote on that, and then we can have further discussion on that as well.
Okay. Does everybody have a copy of that amendment? Okay. Assuming they do. Okay. All those in favor of adopting the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
Aye.
Okay. The ayes have it. The amendment is adopted. And if you would proceed, Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I mentioned already as this to start here. So the Duluth Entertainment and Convention Center was formed as a state authority in 1963 and designated as an economic engine for northern Minnesota. It has 11 board members, 7 appointed by the mayor and 4 by the governor. And the enabling legislation has only been updated once in 1998. The proposed bill, House File 1947, maintains the original intent of the statute, but updates it to become more modern with the business standards and accurately reflect the current operations of the DEC. So the bill includes updating the language to be consistent with bylaws, including the board president, change to the board chair, updated outdated gender pronouns to become gender neutral language, and updated the bid requirement to 50,000, which is consistent with other entities. And with that, I will turn it over. I have 2 testifiers today. I have Roger Reinert, who is the interim executive director and former state senator, and he was a previous DEC board member. So he is here to answer questions. And Lynn Williams, who is a governor's appointed board member, chair of the governance committee, and also works at UMD, and she is here to provide testimony.
Okay. Ms. Williams, if you would identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Mason. My name is Lynn Williams, and I am part of the DEC board and very honored to be here today. So thank you for your time. As Representative Olson said, this is really a housekeeping. The board is going through updating our bylaws, and in the process of doing that, we realized the state statute hadn't been touched in over 2 years. And these were some relatively routine edits that we wanted to make change there, just to make sure that we're up to date and that we've had an opportunity to review those. So pretty routine changes, nothing really out of the ordinary or nothing that changes the original intent. The bid amount, the reason for that edit is that the board had a chance to meet a couple weeks ago, and in that conversation presented information of other like entities and what their bid amounts were, and that's where we landed on that $50,000 for the bid amount then. But that's really about the general overview, unless there's any other information we can provide.
Thank you. And Senator Reinert, welcome to the House. And it sounds like you were just there for questions.
Yes, ma'am.
Good morning, Madam Chair. I am here to answer questions if I can be helpful. Otherwise, our governance chair, Ms. Williams, I think presented the bill appropriately.
Nice to see you. I am not seeing any questions. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I understand the discussion about the change in the limit, but 2,500% increase in a limit seems a tad greater than the rate of inflation. And I noticed that originally it was a much smaller one. And so it gives me a little consternation when something's changed to that percentage. And I wish we had, maybe the committee had gotten information ahead of time of these are all the different comparable situations and, understand that. But I just, that's a huge, huge shift. And I just wanted to make sure it was stated on the record for the public that we are noticing when things change so drastically. Thank you, Madam.
Okay, thank you. That seems to be all. Representative Olson, I don't know if you want to respond or make your closing comments, please.
Madam Chair, I think Mr. Reinert can respond to that comment or note if you would like to, and then I can do a quick wrap up. So we'll be brief here.
Very briefly, Representative Quam, completely understood. Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Quam completely understood. We did the CPI math and then did comparables with the City of Duluth, the Port Authority, and the airport. Those are comparables in northeastern Minnesota. I'd be happy to send you that information. It's pretty detailed. And I would just note that just raises the maximum. It doesn't mean that the board can't still choose to exercise a lower level, being responsible with their public duties. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you. Representative Olson, your closing comments.
Just thank you, Madam Chair, for the time in the committee and for my testifiers for being here, and I just ask for member support of this.
Okay. I will move House File 1947, as amended, be recommended to be referred to State Government Finance and Elections Committee. The clerk will take the roll, please.
Representative Mason.
Yes.
Representative Elkins.
Aye.
Representative Quam.
Yes.
Representative Berg.
Yes.
Representative Bolden.
Aye.
Representative Hewitt.
Aye.
Representative Mecklen.
Aye.
Representative Olson.
Yes.
Representative Joaquin.
Yes.
We have 9 ayes.
Okay. The motion prevails and you are on your way. Thank you so much, everybody. Next, we have Representative Mike Nelson. And I would like to move House File 1671, and it will be going back to State Government Finance and Elections Committee. And we'll be voting on this bill at 9:58. Representative Nelson, your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And this bill is about, we put a statute in so that counties, cities can to bid for small projects and out to disadvantaged businesses, women-owned businesses, veteran-owned businesses. And they have been successful in getting some of these businesses to be able to learn how to work with the county and to vote on or to bid on these projects and get work, spread the work around, and help some of these disadvantaged businesses succeed. What the bill does is just moves the cap on what these contracts can be from $250,000 to $750,000. And I have a couple testifiers here. I have a Michael Rosenfeld from the Hennepin County Purchasing Department and a Mike Hickey from the Minnesota Federation of Independent Businesses. And they can, Mr. Rosenfeld can describe the bill better than, probably better than me.
Okay. Mr. Rosenfeld, if you would identify yourself and proceed, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Good morning. My name is Michael Rosenfeld. I'm the manager of negotiated procurement in the Hennepin County Purchasing Department. As Representative Nelson just explained, this legislation will enable counties to increase their contracting with small businesses, which has been a priority for Hennepin County. During the last 5 years, Hennepin County has been focusing on offering contract opportunities to small businesses for construction and professional services. We've established several programs to promote those objectives. I'd like to explain how this legislation would have a significant positive impact on the three programs the county created for small building contractors. The first of those programs was created for residential remodelers. This was a program that was created to offer the opportunity to small business remodelers to rehabilitate tax forfeited houses that the county took possession of. That work was necessary in order to have these properties marketable when they were put back and sold in the marketplace. Based on the success of that program, we created two programs for small commercial contractors. The purpose of that program was to offer these small businesses the opportunity to work on small repair and remodeling projects in county facilities. With each of these programs, the county marketed the opportunity to all the small construction businesses that were certified as small businesses through the small business certification program that the county relies on. That program is referred to as CERT. It's a small business certification program for businesses that are located within a 15-county area, which is basically the MSMA for Minneapolis, St. Paul, the region. So any small business within those 15 counties can apply at no cost to be certified as a small business. The acronym used for those businesses is an SBE, small business enterprise. These programs that I just described, the opportunity was extended to any SBE firm that was in the directory of this small business certification program. We were oversubscribed by applications from small businesses for each of these programs. And in fact, we had to then conduct a public lottery to select the firms for the limited spots that we had in the program. Last year, when we added three more additional spots to one of the programs, we had 19 small businesses apply for three spots. And I mention that because it reflects the high level of interest these small businesses have in working for the county. It really is important work for them. It helps credential them with other customers, with their banks. And I think it's fair to say that working for a government entity can be transformative, a game changer for many small businesses. We've seen that. As Representative Nelson mentioned, in 2018, the legislature increased the amount that counties could directly bid to small businesses from $100,000 to $250,000. That increase was important.
Can you wrap up so we can get to the other testifier? I'm sorry, we're close to running out of time.
Certainly. This legislation is important because it would allow counties to offer contract opportunities to small businesses for contracts that are more typical of the size of the construction and remodeling projects that we have. Right now we have to carve out small portions of a project to offer a small business the opportunity to participate in that project. We've seen great work delivered by these small businesses. We're confident that they can deliver more work to us, and we would like to have that opportunity to offer them the ability to compete for larger contracts. Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I would be happy to answer any questions from members of the committee.
Thank you. Mike Hickey, if you would identify yourself, and if you could keep your testimony down to a minute or two, I apologize, but we're almost out of time.
Sure, Madam Chair, Mike Hickey with the National Federation of Independent Business. I could have given all my time to to Michael. He's the program expert here. But I just first of all wanted to thank Representative Nelson for bringing this bill forward. And this is just a really rare positive thing going on here. There's no opponents. This is just, you know, uniquely rare positive thing going on. Hennepin County and the other counties are really have small business in mind. They're trying to help small businesses. We have a lot of people struggling in this environment, but just the goal itself, you know, pandemic or not, to try to get more small businesses involved with these contracts and now expanding it up to 750,000 will really create a lot more opportunities. And so this is just very encouraging and positive. And we hope the House acts on this and hope the Senate does also, and we can do something to really help small business.
Okay, thank you very much. Representative Maitland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do have a question for Michael Rosenfeld. You made reference to it was at 100,000, then it was elevated to 250,000 some time ago. But now we're going from 250,000 to 750,000. Can you help me understand why such a big jump? I mean, I understand that building trades are going up. I get it, trust me. But this seems to be a very significant increase. If you could help explain why so much.
Mr. Rosenfeld.
Yes, Representative. The reason we recommend this increase in the size is because it would open up the range of contract opportunities of projects that are really typical for our county and for most counties. As I the cost, for example, the cost of $250,000 does not go very far in terms of a remodeling project. For example, a typical office remodel, $250,000 might get you a quarter of a floor if the entire floor were to be remodeled. So operating with that limitation, we find that we can offer a small portion of the project to a small business, and then inevitably a large contractor will win the remainder of the floor. And what we're trying to do is be in a position to offer half the floor, or if not the entire floor, to that smaller business. They can deliver that project successfully. If the contracts require bonding, if the business has the capacity and is backed by a surety so that they can bond and provide insurance to the county, we would like to be in a position to offer them that opportunity. And that's the reason for this increase, simply so that we could include more of the typical projects, the typical remodeling projects that we have every year. Right now, they're just of a size that where we can't offer them to small businesses through this authority.
Thank you. Representative Quam, if you can be quick, please.
Yeah, so thank you to the author and the testifiers. It'd be nice if before the next committee there was sort of a breakdown of quantity of, you know, over the last 5 years there have been 10 and within this price bracket, but there's 150 if we take it up and double it, and then there's 300 or, you know, whatever the number is, you know, when you increase it more. So that way we can have some sort of an idea what this does. It is a large increase, but I think it'd be easier to understand if we saw the quantities in the different size brackets, and that way it'd help us understand, well, we're opening it up X more business, if you understand what I'm saying, to the author.
I'll have
Representative Nelson.
Madam Chair and Representative Quam, I'll have Mr. Rosenfeld get that information. There was information in your packet of projects that have been done by the county and cities in the area. So, see if Mr. Rosenfeld can get us that information for the next committee.
Any closing remarks?
Madam Chair, it's a good bill. The cost of construction and the ability to use this exemption to be able to help small businesses, it's a good thing that we're trying to do, and help them grow into bigger businesses to where they don't need this help.
Okay. Thank you. I will renew my motion that House File 1671 be recommended to be re-referred to State Government Finance and Elections Committee. Josh, if you take the roll, please.
Representative Mason.
Aye.
Representative Elkins.
Aye.
Representative Quam.
Aye.
Representative Byrd.
Aye.
Representative Bolden.
Aye.
Representative Hewitt.
Aye.
Representative Mecklen.
Aye.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Joachim.
Aye.
Madam Chair, we have 9 ayes.
Okay, thank you. The motion prevails, and Chair Nelson, you are on your way. Thank you, everybody. I will now adjourn today's meeting. Have a good day.